Welcome to the Honeydew, y'all. This episode is sponsored by Vincero Watches. More on that later. Let's get to the episode.
You're listening to the Honeydew with Ryan Sickler.
Welcome back to the Honeydew, y'all. We're doing it over here at Studio Jeans at your mom's house. I am Ryan Sickler. Ryan Sickler on all social media, ryansickler.com. Got some dates for you here. What do we have? August 1st through 3rd, the House of Comedy in Minnesota. September 14th, I'll be at the Famous in Baltimore. Come out and see those shows. And as always, every week, thank you for all the positive feedback. Thank you for the messages, everything. Please make sure you're subscribed. Get over to your mom's house podcast YouTube page, subscribe there, get all the shows you got going on over here at Studio Jeans. The website here is thehoneydewpodcast.com. That's where you can find everything you need, the email, the social media links, all that stuff. And if you're new to the show, as I say every week, we over here, we highlight the lowlights, and these are the stories behind the storytellers. And I couldn't be more excited to have my guest here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Drew.
Here we are, man.
Hear that?
How about that? Wow. Yeah. Legit, it's like those guys have never seen me before.
Dude.
Crazy.
I'm so stoked to have you here, man.
I'm pleased
Thank
to be
you
here.
For doing the show.
You know, I was thinking how high and tight I'm feeling, for number one. Number two.
Your jeans are pulled all the way up.
Number two. Number two, how great are the fans at your mom's house?
They're awesome.
When you were saying thank you, I thought I should make that more explicit when I open my show. Because it is a great, great community.
They're great. And I even have, like I say, friends and family back home that jump into the comment. They're like, do you read them? I'm like, some, not all of them. But they're like, you have really good fans.
Yeah.
Really
yeah,
loyal they, fans, smart
these guys,
fans.
These guys put together that crazy t-shirt I have going like, people buy them. Thank you for buying those t-shirts. I was a little embarrassed by them, but I appreciate you buying those t-shirts. It shouldn't be bigger than this, all I'm saying.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting into it with you. But before we do, please feel free. Plug everything, promote whatever you'd like.
In this very studio, the doctor, where am I looking here? I'm not used to the middle one.
That's our wide.
That one. Okay.
That's you.
That's right. Dr. Drew Podcast in this very studio. Usually I'm looking at that camera. That's why I'm not sure what to do here. But yeah, check Doctor After Dark, and also at doctor.com. Me and Adam Carolla have a show called Adam and Dr. Drew Show, and then the Dr. Drew Podcast, and I have a radio show in Los Angeles, so check that all out.
How many total shows?
We're sort of trying to hone them down a little bit. Some come and go. They have This Life with Bob Forrest, got the hat and glasses from Celebrity Rehab. I was doing Swole Patrol, a health and fitness thing with Mike Catherwood, who was guest on Dr. Drew Podcast a couple weeks ago. And but now we're just trying to get back to the basics.
All right. Well, I know you're a busy man, and again, I can't thank you enough for being here. And one of the reasons I'm stuck, I mentioned this to you when I did your show, which I'm not sure whose is going to come out first, Dr. Drew. But back in my day, when I was a kid, the doctor of the time was Dr. Ruth. And I discovered Dr. Ruth right in that time where I discovered masturbation, you know, that seventh, eighth, ninth grade window. And I would listen to Dr. Ruth, like, I want to say it was Sundays. And, you know, back when I had headphones and, you know, if you touched the metal to another piece of metal, it would sound even better. You could get better reception. And I just remember listening to her and hearing these people call in, and I would hear, you know, these girls would talk about giving their boyfriends blowjobs, and I'm like, oh my God. And then I start masturbating to the girls calling in, interrupted by Dr. Ruth speaking, and I'm like, hurry up and get over your fucking advice.
It's the custom.
And, you know, I never did jerk off to your show, not that it wasn't jerk off worthy, but I feel as though, so I was a big fan of Dr. Ruth. She came and spoke at my community college. I will never forget the story she told. She was talking about keeping it fresh in the bedroom. And she said she had a patient who she and her husband would, in the bedroom, he would get an erection and she would throw onion rings on it and then eat the onion rings off. This is coming from Dr. Ruth, okay? Who I feel like was 80 when I was fucking 10, okay? Right. And it just blew me away that this lady was so into this and was such a professional. And I did end up learning so much. So then fast forward to, not too much later, you guys come around, you and Carolla, and I was just such a huge fan of Loveline.
See, I'd been doing, by the time Carolla arrived, I'd been doing Loveline 15 years.
Are you serious?
Or 12 years.
That
started in 83.
So who was your first co-host?
Poor Man.
Okay. So, but also what I did realize is where sex had gone.
Yeah.
From these innocent stories right. I would hear.
Right.
To and, what you guys, and I was right. like, holy shit,
and
what
that's
a leap.
Actually, I used to really object to Dr. Ruth because she did not talk about, all she was talking about was, we got to have good sex. I'm like, you don't understand. It's gone, woo. And the consequences yeah. biologically are profound.
Yeah.
She seemed to have no awareness about HIV and AIDS and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, this is irresponsible. Now, since I've gotten to know her in recent years, she is spectacular. She is the real deal. She's an academic in her background.
She has a new Netflix special,
she,
I think, right?
Or she was an somewhere. Israeli sniper.
What? It,
she speaks like three different languages. She escaped the Nazis into Sweden during the Second World War. I mean, just an amazing human being. Yeah, amazing human being. And even though I objected to her missing what I thought was so important, I'm a full advocate for Dr. Ruth. And she has looked the same as when I first found her in the 80s.
She really does. Yeah. So I want to get into your life, but I do want to ask you a little bit, like, as far as practicing, you know, you're a doctor. Mm-hmm. What is it like when you have, I guess for a while, you're floating along with this standard set of STDs that are out there. Then all of a sudden something like AIDS comes and then all these other things come. How do you adapt professionally to work, not only educate yourself, but then to help educate your patients? Or can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Or do the patients coming in actually help educate you?
Well, of course, the cases educate us, but it's, you know, you learn from your subspecialty peers, right? So I read all the literature I read, and then I see what my infectious disease consultant friends are doing, that kind of thing. And then I get the experience of the cases. So it's sort of it's a multi-level experiential learning that doctors go through. And then you sort of, you know, then you have experience applying what the subspecialists are doing and you get a feel for it, if that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense. Do you find yourself, like, because you're so knowledgeable about the body, do you find yourself, like, ever over-worrying about shit inside you going on?
No.
You feel like those tears when I'm driving?
No,
I'm like, oh,
no.
My God.
No, the other opposite. This is why doctors don't take care of themselves or their family. It's completely pushed away. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's nothing. Oh my God, I'm going to die. It's one right, or the other.
I got it.
And it has, and it takes a lot to get from here to here.
All right.
And, but I would do that with my kids all the time. So I'd be like, oh, I'm not paying attention. Oh shit, they have leukemia. I'm sure of it. And, that's why you don't take care of your own family. You can't be objective.
So let's go back to the beginning. Where are you from originally? Where did you grow up?
I grew up originally Alhambra and then Pasadena.
Okay.
And, my dad was a family practitioner, first-generation immigrant from, his parents came over from Belarus and Ukraine, had a very big hassle to get into the country. You know, they was not exactly welcoming Russian Jews into the United States. Had to go through Canada and find sponsors and, you know, a place to land and prove how you're going to make a living. And I guess they had a restaurant or something when the Depression hit and was completely wiped out. And were nearly homeless, which freaked my dad out completely. And my grandfather ended up becoming a grocer in Chicago, Elmwood, I think, Elmhurst. And they kind of did okay after that. And then my dad went to medical school and whatnot and moved out here.
And at what, and you were born?
58.
So your family relocates here,
yeah.
And then what starts getting you into medicine, being a doctor? What sparks your interest?
I think always I'm going to do what dad does, this kind of thing. And there was always an assumption, you know, immigrant families, you're going to be a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. That's just what you're going to do. And was always very good in the sciences. But actually, when I was in college, I abandoned the whole project for about 2 years.
You did? Where'd you go to college?
I went to Amherst College.
Okay.
And so here I was in this super rigorous academic environment in New England. Didn't really know how I got there or why I was there. And I just thought, I'm just not up for this. I'm not that smart. I can't do this. And I spent about a year and a half just fucking around doing music and theater. And I thought I was going to be an opera singer for 2 minutes.
You did?
Yeah.
Can you belt out a few lines?
No,
real quick,
I will not do that.
You sure?
Yeah. Positive. And I think of this episode of Ridiculousness, though, where I do sing. So they got me to do it there. So, and then I became miserable. I became miserable. I left college for a while, and I started getting depressed and panic attacks. And
why? Do you know? Can you trace it back?
I think it was, I had a girlfriend that had broken up with me. I was had no stable identity. My identity was very wishy-washy. The whole experience of going to New England and not knowing what I wanted to do and rejecting everything I thought it always would do was... And I had some really serious psychological issues that took a long time before I ever dealt with them. And I got severely depressed and severe disabling panic attacks and then disabling generalized anxiety. And I knew enough to go to first I went to the mental health services at the college. And they, of course, sent me down to the medical thing to make sure that they wanted me to get me some Valium. And the doctor, you know, back then there was almost no student health services. There was no adolescent health. And that's why I eventually became interested in young people's health, because no one was focused on them. And what was down there was some retired physician who was like donating his time in the afternoon. And he looked at me, he goes, just get it together and take long walks in the woods. He's like very disdainful, like, just get it together. Just walk in the woods. You'll be fine. I'm like, could Jesus Christ, that would make me fine. I sure as hell would do it. And so I'll never forget that. I will never forget that. It was, you know, and then I was mostly mismanaged for a couple of years after that. Anyway, in the middle of all that, I started, you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And finally, I can't do that science stuff because that's what everybody else wanted me to do. I won't even consider it. I let it in one day and I just thought, well, maybe I am okay at that. And I immediately felt better.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know, if you pushed it away at first. Because a lot of people do
just
that.
Like, I have no way I'm going to do that. And when I went back, I had a different brain. Not only did I own this and it was mine and I was enthusiastic about it, I'd matured. I literally was not capable. I didn't have the focus to do it the way I needed to do it. So I'm glad I waited.
So do you think that you always knew you would, and the anxiety,
don't? Oh, no. I was just adrift. I was adrift. And I didn't like that, clearly.
Now, you said you had some serious psychological problems. Can we talk about that?
So I've only told you about my dad. My mom was a trip. She was an opera singer. I had a weird vivid.
Oh, there's your opera. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then a B-movie, like film noir actress, and was in television, like Highway Patrol and all those crazy things from the 50s. And she was not effective. It's the kindest thing I can say as a parent. Was moderately abusive most of the time. In fact, sometimes severely abusive to me.
In what ways? Physically?
Screaming. No, never touched, but screaming and yelling and just demeaning and that kind of stuff. And didn't really get what I needed to be able to talk about in psychological terms, to sort of hook up with my own spontaneous feeling states. Mm-hmm. I didn't, no one ever reflected this stuff back to me, so I didn't have any access to it. And it took years of therapy to connecting that back up. And that's where a lot of the anxiety was. I was just disconnected. And that your body only leaves you with anxiety when you can't have your feelings. It's one of the sources of anxiety.
So does it affect you as a student? Like, how are you? Were you then, a good student always?
I was always a great student. You were. I was always a good student. But obviously, for a year and a half, it affected me greatly.
So what situations would you see it play out in? Through life until
bad relationship,
you just always
longing, horrible longing, and just I would clinging in relationships, and just really yuck, not good.
But your parents were together;
they stayed together, and my dad was pretty much of a narcissist too. He was a nice guy, but narcissistic, and so you know, it was his way or the highway, and anything that you know, any needs outside of their needs were met with complete rejection. That's the narcissistic way. And then my mom was just maniac a lot of the time, screaming at me like unbelievable.
Your dad too?
Nope.
Just you?
Just, no. Oh, she yelled at him? Yeah, later years would yell at him, yeah.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a sister.
She yelled at her like that too?
My sister remembers the yelling, but somehow wasn't affected by it. So it wasn't directed at her, I don't think, ever.
So you get through.
Oh, more with my mom. And so I'm doing Loveline one night, and I had a friend of mine in there who was interested in noir films. And he started looking up her background and stuff on the internet. He goes, oh, here's your mom's profile. Helene Stanton, married first. I go, oh, really? Married before?
You had known that?
No idea. No idea. She was about 80 at this time. And I was like, oh, really? She was married to a silent film star. This kind of gives you the sense of who she was. She left Philadelphia, where she was an opera singer, with a man who was 56, the fifth wife at age 18.
18 and 56? Dude, you're giving me fucking heart palpitations.
Came out here, lived with him for 10 years, had a stepson for 10 years.
Who was 48.
Yeah, he was like late teens or something. Right. And she left him when it was time to leave. Just boom, never, no contact with anybody ever again.
Just cut off like that.
I found this, when I found out about this, I was giving, Carole and I were doing an event at Santa Barbara one time. This woman came up to me and goes, I need to give you an amends. I got an amends. Why? For my grandfather. I went, oh, we need to talk. And she was the daughter of the stepson. And so I ended up calling the stepson, who's now a retired dentist in Stockton. And we gave my mother many opportunities to come clean about it. Totally denied it.
Denied it. Say it. I didn't want to talk about it. Just denied was like, it. That did not happen.
Did not happen. She reminds me of Don Draper. You know, remember, yeah, remember when she was in, he's in the psych hospital with Peggy and he goes, you'll be surprised how easy it is for things just to not happen. That was her thing. Just didn't happen. Okay. Talk about compartmentalization.
Yeah, no shit.
Anyway, that gives you a sense of what I was contending with.
So, so let's go back to you free yourself from the anxiety. You're owning what you're going to do now.
We're now in college now?
Yeah, back to college. Okay. Your anxiety, I wouldn't say, is it over or you've pushed past? At least you've gotten to the point where I know now what I'm going to do.
The panic attacks stopped and the depression stopped a bit.
And what kind of attacks would you have? What would happen?
Oh, like dissociative. Like I would, like the world would sort of float away and I'd feel like I was not there. It was very weird. Very
would it be
intense.
Specific moments or crowds or public?
Crowds
or
was part
yourself?
Of it. Public and crowds would trigger. So it was agoraphobia. It got to that point where that would sort of generalize to that stuff. But I couldn't. They would often occur at night, sometimes in bed even. And it was a feeling of dissolving away. And then there's an extreme panic that would go along with that. Ugh. You ever had panic attacks?
I've never had a... one panic attack. I did have one. I was... I guess this is a panic attack. I was hiking Temescal Canyon. Mm. It was right before my daughter was born. I've hiked it a bunch. Still have hiked it since a bunch. I've never had a problem. But this one particular day, I get to the point. There's like this little waterfall area where you can sit and rest for a minute before you continue up. Yep. And I just sat there for a second. And there's these two ladies sitting right, just two Asian ladies. I remember it very vividly, sitting right over here. And I'm sitting against a rock. I start to drink some water, and I just start to feel my heart race. And I start to see the circle close.
Oh, yeah.
And I start to feel myself, like, slip away. I'm starting to slide down the rock, and I just let myself hit hard. And I have my phone in my pocket, but in my mind, I'm on the verge of yelling to these two ladies to call 911. But I'm having this battle, like, why would you do that? You have a phone in your pocket. And then I was like, just fucking breathe. And I sat there for a while, I breathed, and I got through it. And that's the only time I can say I've ever had something like that. I feel like that was a pan. I don't feel like I was about to pass out from exercise. I feel like that was a panic attack. There was a lot of shit about to happen.
Okay, it sounds like it, but it could have been arrhythmia too, right? Sometimes your heart can get into rhythms where your adrenaline goes up and it feels like a panic attack, but it's actually caused by the cardiac arrhythmia.
And you can pass out from that?
Yeah. So you might want to get to check that one.
I have. I told you. I've had those new heart scan checks done. Yep. I thought, even my doctor said, you're going to have something. With your family history,
yeah, I remember
something.
You told me that. Yeah.
And I was clear. So I go every 6 months. I get my EKGs. I get all that stuff.
Right.
As my doctor said, if something happens, you got all the paperwork that you did everything.
Right.
You could have.
Right.
We'll see. So,
So that was sort of a miserable time. Super, super miserable. And then once I got into the pre-medical training, it was crazy intense. And it was all, I remember that as a miserable time because I didn't know if it was going to yield anything, if I was going to get into medical school or anything. So once I got in, I started really enjoying myself.
And there's no times where you're like doubting yourself or ever second guessing again?
The whole time. Oh, about going a different direction?
Yes.
No, though the degree of sacrifice and the intensity of work, I was wondering if it was worth it. But I enjoyed it. I was into it. Yeah. So I didn't. I went year round to school at that point too. I was deeply in.
And what did you like? What were some of your early failures?
I was a terrible football player. I remember This was at a small high school, so the fact that I could even play football was sort of, okay. So Adam gives me shit about all the time. but he calls it Little Lord Fauntleroy School for Albino Hemophiliacs. So that was my school. But freshman year, I mean, it really hit me hard. I was like, whoa, I wasn't prepared for what football was like. And I decided I was going to quit. And I remember this one coach came up to me and he got right in my face. He goes, you can do this. He goes, I know you're thinking you're on the fence, but you're good. You can do it. And so I dug in again, ended up warming the bench for a while, like most of the season. I was still very, very frustrated with it. But once I decided to dig into it, I thought I'm going to use this as a challenge. And so I kind of committed myself. And I remember the last season of the year, they had a bunch of injuries and they put me in. And
position?
Defensive end, if I remember right.
Defensive end. That must have been a small school.
Yeah. Well, I was about 30 pounds heavier probably too then.
Okay.
And I had some interceptions and I made the game, won the game and everything. And I remember I remember the coach sat me down in the bus like, you know, you're the question mark, different coach. You're the question mark in this lineup. We don't know if you're really right for this position, so we'll give you a try out there. It's like I thought to myself at the time, that fuck you.
Yeah,
I was like,
seriously.
Well, thank you for that. Right now, really?
Right. Yeah.
So it sort of motivated me even more.
I had a moment like that.
I ended up being captain of the football team.
You did?
Ultimately, yeah. I got pretty good. Got very good.
Defensive end, you stayed defensive end?
I played in the trenches all the way, both ways and stuff. And
you get you though.
I learned how to hit. Yeah.
I had a moment. This was right after my father died in high school, and I was active in sports, and it was one of the things that really helped just for a couple hours take my mind off of
that shit. Oh, my God. So I think football, I don't care how many cells I lost, vitally important to me.
All sports, yeah. I agree. I was just telling my daughter last night, like, I'm still friends with some of the guys I played sports with in elementary school.
Yep.
You know, it's just a bonding experience.
There's something about this, I've only seen this in males, there's something about putting yourself in harm's way on behalf of your peers. There's nothing like it. When I had my kids play tackle football when they were in fourth grade, because there's no real contact with that, but it gives them the basics, tackling and blocking and stuff. And I remember each kid, they'd start carrying themselves differently. It scared them to be out there, but they're like, okay, I'm doing it for the team. It changed them, even at 9-10 years of age. It was crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm going into this, it's a tournament, and they're asking me as a 165 pounder or whatever I was to do the 185 or 187 weight class. And I'm weighing in my singlet, my headgear. I'm eating a cup of pudding on the scale. You know, all the other kids are in their underwear and everything else. And I know I'm giving 20 pounds. And if it's fat, I can handle it. If it's muscle, I'm getting my ass kicked. And I just look across. I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me. This kid was Hercules. And I was like, I'm going to get my fucking ass kicked.
Yeah.
And we went out. And the kid just stuck his neck out a little too far, and I hit him with a headlock. I pinned him in 17 seconds. I ended up having the fastest pin in the whole tournament, right? And we get on the bus, and the coach is giving out these little awards, wherever he goes, and this award, and I'm like, oh, here comes the fastest pin in the tournament. But the way he says it is, goes to the guy that should have never won the match he won, Ryan. I was like, you fucking piece of shit.
Oh, that's
you
funny.
Fucking piece of shit. So as always, I ask everyone that comes in with some stories, and one of the stories that Nadav said, something you struggle with, health, was you have prostate cancer.
I sure do.
Do?
Yeah.
Still.
You have cancer. You never know if it's, I don't care what the cancer is.
Okay.
You never know. So this is, again, to me, with my catastrophic thinking about myself, I had a severe illness. My wife and I went to the Caribbean, and I came back. On the way back, I just felt this horrible illness. The words came out of my mouth I never imagined. Take me to the emergency room. Something's terribly wrong.
And what is
a fever and chills and weakness and almost confusion. It turns out I have H1N1 and pneumonia, this horrible virus. I thought I had leptospirosis because I've been in the islands where there's a leptospirosis outbreak and stuff, because it really seemed horrible. And took me out a week of, I mean, I was toxic as hell. And after that, my wife goes, well, that wasn't normal. And I go, yeah, it was a bad illness. And she goes, oh, no, something's wrong. I go, you know, you need to get a physical. I go, I've got a cardiologist. I've got a pulmonologist. I get my friends. I'm making an appointment for a physical for you. All right, I'll get a physical. I get a physical. Normally, I watch my own cholesterol and my own PSA and stuff. Get a physical. PSA had gone from 1 to 4. All normal readings. 4 is still normal. And the guy who's now my doctor to this day just goes, I need to see a urologist. I went, come on, I'll test it again in 6 months. I just don't feel comfortable. See a urologist. I'm like, all right, I'll do it. Went to the urologist. The urologist goes, yeah, you shouldn't even be here. Let's give you some antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, probably prostatitis.
Can I ask you a question real quick at this point here? Yeah. Especially as a doctor. Yeah. Are you hesitant about these doctors you're seeing or these people you know?
People I know and I trust.
But are there... Your wife said she's going to make an appointment for...
Well, I knew who that was. And I trusted him to send me to somebody, and I knew the guy was good.
All right.
And
prostatitis.
So prostatitis, he treats me. We'll recheck your PSA. Doesn't go down. He's like, I'll do another round. Antibiotic. Doesn't go down. Well, we need to do a biopsy. I'm like, God damn it. I'm so mad at everybody. I'll come back in 6 months. We'll check it again. See what happens when you do too much to patients. You just got to be more reasonable, conservative. Biopsy, cancer. So a lot to be learned from this.
Yeah, please educate us.
Good judgment. Two doctors who use their judgment. You see doctors to use because of their judgment. That's why you go.
Good wife.
My wife also good judgment. So my wife's, I would call that more intuition. So my wife's intuition saved my life. My doctor, first doctor's great judgment that something just didn't feel right.
Fair enough.
Second doctor going through the procedures and doing what was right, got to the right place. And that was that. And they, again, you go to a physician to him or she to apply their judgment. The knowledge base goes without saying. We all have the same knowledge base, but that ability to really apply the right judgment at the right time for your particular situation is why you want a doctor. And so now it's like, all right, it's a low Gleason score. I can wait a while. So I'm like, I'll get an operation in a year or something. And then I found active surveillance where they re-biopsy you repeatedly over like every 6 to 12 months. So I went on active surveillance and the thing grew a little too much. So it was like time to get that's it. Prostate out. Big surgery.
Were you scared?
For the surgery?
From all of it.
When you first get diagnosed. Yeah. When you first get diagnosed, you go, I was like, God. I was like, first of all, I had a lot going on in my life that I really was happy doing. And it was like being just, as always, pulled out of the sky, number one. Number two, it was prostate cancer. I thought my dad had it. My uncle had it. I thought I was going to get it at 70. 50? Really? 50? God damn it. God damn it. It's like, come on. Come on. I felt like, God. And you feel an amazing kind of sinking feeling. It's like, whoa.
So that's a hereditary.
Yeah. I have something called Lynch syndrome, which puts me at risk for a lot of stuff. Prostate amongst it. And so got the prostate out, which was a big operation and took a while to get over. But no consequences. All good.
How long did it take you to recover from that?
I don't think I was right for a year.
A year? But I thought you were going to say a month.
But I went back to work in 10 days.
Of course you did.
Yeah. So thank you for the sounds.
You're nuts.
Yeah. I think anesthesia I do really poorly. I do poorly with anesthesia and tissue damage. I think that those are the things that really get me.
What do you mean tissue?
Somebody cutting.
Cutting
somebody,
you?
Yeah, opening.
What sort of struggles did you have, especially while working, recovering with that?
Just weak and weakened out of it. Yeah, weak. Oof. But I was pretty okay after about. I had a live TV show on HLN, and I would lie down during every commercial. And so
you would.
Oh yeah, I couldn't tolerate. I just had to lie down. So for about 2 weeks after I went back to work, I was a little goofy, and then I was pretty good at work. I was pretty good. I wasn't myself. I didn't have stamina, you know what I mean? I didn't have vitality the way I'm used to having. And so I didn't notice that wasn't happening, frankly, because I was like, I'm working. This is great. I'm back at work. Everything's fine. I can have sex. Well, my penis works, you know. What are you looking at me like that for?
I'm learning so fucking much. I'm learning so goddamn much. And every time I hear these kinds of things, I get scared.
Well,
I hear cancer.
We're all going to get something.
Yeah, I've read that if you live long enough, that's how you're going to get anyway. Cancer.
Well, no, you're going to die with prostate cancer.
Oh, is that
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. All males get prostate cancer if they live to 100. And that's how inconsequential it is as you get older. But
which is why you're saying I'll go get checked later, and I'm not. I don't have.
Well, because I know it's slow growing, and I know you could overdo it, and I was 50. I was like, yeah. Oh my God, that was making me so angry. Ugh. But I would take that cancer over just about any other one, because there's a lot of bad ones.
Yeah, there are a lot of bad ones. That's why I'm saying I think people hear that C word and they just get scared.
Yeah, right, I know all about all of them, so I know exactly what each one means. So I talked to a friend of mine last week who has pancreatic cancer. And that was really hard.
Yeah.
That's a terrible disease.
So you're doing all this work. Is this back in the early days of K-Rock? When was this?
What are we talking about? When was what?
When you had your cancer. You have 50.
No, that was 10 years ago.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so back to early days of K-Rock.
Yeah.
How do you get your start there?
Oh, that's total. I should tell that story. It's an accident. Pretty much everything in my life that's not been directed in medicine has been an accident. Even addiction medicine was an accident. Like I'm an internist, right? And so I was heading towards cardiology. That's actually where I was headed. And I was very good in intensive care medicine. That kind of thing. I sort of have a talent for that. And somebody asked me to go moonlight in a psychiatric hospital down the road, which I'd always heard of. I lived in Pasadena. There's always this place behind the walls. Went in there. I was like, oh my God, this place is beautiful. And how interesting. There's all these things here. And I became fascinated with it. And I just kept moonlighting there all the way through my residency. And I ended up working regularly there and taking over their department of medicine. And so while I was doing my general medical practice, I also had this medicine practice, or instead of the medical care of the psychiatric patient at the psych hospital. Well, all the medical problems were down on the drug unit. We got very good at doing drug withdrawal, which was something I was never trained on because there was no discipline of that. And I started getting interested in the disease of addiction. And in 1991, interestingly, I'd forgotten this piece. The guy with the pancreatic cancer was the director of the addiction program, and he called me and said, hey, be the assistant director, because if I'm on vacation or something, I need somebody to cover me. You're there all the time anyway. It's no big deal. And 6 months later, he quit. And so I had to move into the position of director, at least temporarily, and I really got it together and trained myself. It took me about 5 years to really get real expertise in the subject, and fell in love with it. I really enjoyed doing it. So that's where the addiction came by. The radio where the first accident came from. I was living in Pasadena. K-Rock was in Pasadena, about 300 yards from where I lived. And it became popular overnight. It was crazy. In like 1982, it was all of a sudden out of nowhere, this station emerged. And all my friends were listening to it, and everyone was interested in it. And people were starting to socialize with like air staff and stuff over there. And one guy was brainstorming with some guys, and he called me. He goes, you know, they've got this late night show. They went to their program director, and they, you know, they have to make it a community service show. And they just want to do a show where they call, you know, people call in and get advice from their friends or these disc jockeys, but they need to make a community service. So they want you to come. I told them you were in medical school, and they want you to do a segment called Ask a Surgeon. You'll use big words. It'll be really funny. And I was like, what the fuck? What? And I was eventually convinced to come up there. And I remember my first night, I came up with my gynecology and infectious disease textbooks. I was totally freaked out. I was a medical student still then. I was right at the verge of fourth year. And I was just blown away by what was happening there. I mean, these incredible questions were coming to people, you know, radio staff in the middle of the night. And it was we were just starting to call GRIDS AIDS. We used to call it Gabrielated Intestinal Disease Syndrome. It was just being called AIDS. We didn't have a causative. I think we just maybe had HTLV-3, the causative agent. No treatments, no nothing. And I was treating tons of AIDS patients, particularly once I went to my residency. But even fourth year medical, no, it was probably residency where I really started seeing a lot of them. But I just thought, hey, no one is talking to young people about AIDS. No one. And it was considered bizarre. Like, you don't talk to kids about that. Why would you do that? And it was hard. It was sort of stepping out of line. I was sort of like,
thank God you were like, why wouldn't you?
Well, medicine was sort of is a military system. And when, you know, a youngin steps out of line, they get crushed.
I see.
And I did eventually. My residency director at one point just started screaming at me, something wrong with you. It's disgusting. Why are you doing this? And I stopped. That was during my internship. And the same guy came back around like about 2 weeks later, and he goes, hey, look, I just don't want you to destroy your career. Great advice, shithead.
Yeah.
And now fast forward 2 years, I end up, or 3 years, I end up being his chief resident. I had running the whole program.
There you go, Dr. Drew.
And he goes, hey, you still doing that radio program? I'll tell you what, I'll do it now. Let me do it. I'm like, yeah, right. So I sort of snuck back in after 6 months and started doing it again because I just I felt so compelled. No one was doing it. There was, and remember, I'd had that horrible experience as an adolescent, not being properly treated. Mm-hmm. No one, everyone was like Dr. Ruth telling them how to have great sex. Condoms weren't being discussed.
No.
Sexually transmitted diseases weren't being discussed, and AIDS wasn't being discussed. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was 23 to 25 years of age at the time, and I was like, I know what you guys are up to, and the society didn't seem to realize it at the time. There was like, we'd just been through the sexual revolution, right? And people were like, you know, understood that adults were acting out, but adolescents, why would they do that? They're kids.
Please.
Yeah, please.
They're doing all of it.
Exactly. Well, way more than the adults.
I'm just behind you in age, and I remember high school being educated about condoms and STDs, but it was all, you know, the standard issue, regular STDs you heard about forever.
And then, could you have understood what they were talking about? I couldn't understand it. No. I ended up teaching it. You know,
it was use a condom so you don't get pregnant, right, and get absolutely. An STD. Yeah. Pregnant, honestly, was a
number
bigger
one.
Fear for
way
kids.
No, yeah, way more.
And it wasn't until a year or two later when I'm in college, I was living with my grandmother. I come home. I'll never forget this either. She is sitting in a rocking chair, and she goes, Magic Johnson has AIDS. And I think it's the only time I said, shut the hell up, Grandma. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then, of course, everything was AIDS at first before people understood HIV, AIDS. And I was like, holy shit. And then it was this, like, I think that's when it really hit.
I think that was a threshold for a lot of people.
Yeah, like, wait, that can happen out there?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was a big
We
moment.
Just went from don't get pregnant and don't get herpes to you can die from this.
Right. So I was out there chanting about it all the time. And people were freaked out about herpes and gonorrhea. And so I kept saying, that's all manageable. Don't worry about that. This thing is what you got to concern yourself with. So I was very early to that game.
So that was K-Rock early on. And then you stayed.
K-Rock, and I stayed for 35 years.
Was it Loveline from the get-go?
Yeah,
it was. Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was two or three or four different disc jockeys. I always said, I go, this is not all the, they had all these people on there with an attorney and then two co-hosts. And I was like, this is a parent-child conflict. This is two people. That's it. Just the two of us. Get all these other ones out of here. Finally, I was so frustrated with what the other people were saying. I'm like, I can't be around this anymore. So I quit. And they kicked everybody else out. And then from then on, it was two people.
And now a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Vincero Watches. At Vincero, they create exceptionally crafted timepieces at a fair price. Their products are bold, they're uncompromising, and quite literally, they're the best value in their industry. All right. Their goal as a brand is to inspire as many people as possible to elevate your game. They've received over 16,000 five-star reviews. They have free worldwide shipping. No one takes quality as seriously as they do. All right. There's nothing generic or minimal about the designs. The watches will definitely get you noticed and complimented. They set you apart. I'm telling you, they offer 6 collections for men and 4 collections for women. This one I got, they sent me right here. This is the Chrono S black on black. This thing's awesome. Leather strap. But if leather's not your thing, all the straps will match watches. Scratch resistant face, nice weight. Good quality. It's a great watch. I love it. I'm wearing it day to day. You got to check them out. I know you'll love their watches just as much as I do. So here's what you do. Go to VinceroWatches.com/honeydew and enter promo code honeydew. You'll get 15% off your entire order. All right. The watches are already affordable. You're knocking 15% off of that. It's a great deal. They're exceptionally crafted. They're fairly priced. Get a Vincero watch at VinceroWatches.com/honeydew. With promo code honeydew. Now back to the honeydew. So you've had a million shows. I've watched as many of them as I can. The Celebrity Rehab was one of my favorite. And I've always been fascinated by addiction too. I have a cousin who, he's a paranoid schizophrenic, also an addict. And
bad
I'm
combo.
Fascinated by the stories. I have other family members and friends. I mean, I battle food. I battle, you know, my own addictions. I've had friends gambling, but I've always been intrigued by the way the mind works and the disease that is addiction.
Mm-hmm.
When you get these celebrities, now that's something that you had on television stuff. Yep. Like, what are some of the crazier fucking things you've seen addiction make people do? And is that, am I even saying that right? Would you say it's fair to say addiction makes you do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you name it. I mean, I've seen, you know, injecting into the penis and.
Needles?
Oh, yeah. No, it's routine. That's pretty routine.
For heroin?
Into the neck.
And, I know the neck. For heroin?
Yeah, yeah. Or meth or whatever you're into.
But
heroin mostly. I can't. Those are hard stories to come up with because I've just seen people do crazy stuff.
Have you ever dealt with someone in these shows that was?
I can tell you just generally on the shows.
Have you ever dealt with someone?
I treated 5,000 drug addicts in my career.
Are you serious? Yeah. 5,000. Yeah. Have you ever dealt with someone that you're like, I don't know how you do it, but goddamn, you're crazy successful and you're just keeping plugging along, but you're addicted to shit. Has there ever been?
Oh,
that?
All the time.
Really?
All the time. Where people
the
are
functioning addicts.
Oh, those are amazing. Those are fun. And I always tell them, and I'm never wrong, you're going to lose everything. You're not going to maintain this. And they always have to go. They have to go down.
In order to come back.
Yeah, they'll kind of be okay for a while and cruise along. And sometimes, if I get to them before they really lose control, they can kind of keep it together. But usually they have to lose everything. If they're in drugs, not alcohol, they'll lose everything.
What is it about addiction that attracted you to wanting to help people?
I remember I had two cases where usually I would just do the detoxes, so I really wouldn't see what happened after that. And I had two cases where they asked me to follow them through the treatment, and they were like these young women that were dying, and they ended up like amazing. And I was like, what just happened? I don't understand this. And normally in medicine, you go from dying to chronically ill, you know, or you don't go from dying to amazing or better than you ever knew you'd be.
Right.
I was like, I want to see what happened. How does this work? I just got fascinated with it. So I just kept learning. And I saw many, many crazy, amazing things. It baffles and it astonishes. And
what's the craziest addiction you've had to deal with? Most bizarre addiction you've had to deal with?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Like, I've seen shit on TV where people eat pillows.
No, I know this stuff like that. I wouldn't get the exotica, I don't think. I get the meat and potatoes, meth, heroin, alcohol, shopping, sex, gambling.
But meth has made quite the leap.
Lately.
Yeah.
It's back again.
Right?
It's been in and out. I've seen it go through a couple seconds.
So when did meth start coming around?
Meth came around in the late 80s, actually, when it really
80s.
Started coming. And I declared it would never replace cocaine. I just thought, it's not as rewarding. There's no way. It's too unpleasant. I was wrong. I was completely wrong.
How do you know? Have you done drugs? How do you know that it's not that rewarding?
I've not done meth. I've done cocaine a little bit.
You smoke marijuana?
Smoke marijuana, drank alcohol. I don't like it. I don't really like it. That's so. I feel grateful that way. I feel ungrateful in that opiates also I don't like.
I'm with you on that.
And so when I'm like, and after surgery and stuff, I wouldn't take them. They felt terrible on them. So I'm like, geez, what if I ever get cancer and need them? It's going to be not good. But anyway, my patients are baffled by that. What? Yeah. What do you mean? They're literally incredulous. Like they can't believe it. So what'd you ask me? What other doing drugs and where did meth come from? Meth is just really powerfully addictive once it gets going, and you don't have to do a lot of it. You do it one, two, three times a day, and it's keeping you high all day, and that's it. And that was the part I didn't understand. I thought you had to keep doing meth like cocaine, and so it's more insidious. And here's a little lesson for you. So comparing meth to crack, okay, both of them cause paranoid psychosis, okay? Cocaine always, and this is smoke cocaine, always causes a preoccupation with uniformed officers. Always. SWAT team, police team, army.
That's what you think's going to come in the room.
Always foil in the window and looking at the foil. Always. And we don't know why they do this. And no, neither do they. And they're always looking up in this part of the country in the palm trees. They're always in the palm trees. They're always looking up. It's really weird. The cocaine does that somehow to them. Meth, and by the way, it resolves in 12 hours. If they stop using, it goes away. It goes away like 12, 24 hours. Meth, it's much slower to come on. It can take years to come on. Once it comes on, it takes months to go away. Okay.
Oh, so it can go away.
It goes away. Meth psychosis goes away always.
So I had a guest named Jessa Reed who came on, mm-hmm. and she has a podcast called The Mormon and the Meth Head. Her partner is a former Mormon. She's a former meth head.
Okay.
Recovered mom. She's fantastic.
Okay, before you tell the story, let me just tell you,
yes.
sir, because I'm going to predict the future here. Meth psychosis is always a preoccupation with family, friends, coworkers, and neighbors. And
aliens.
Oh, well, if you get going and up. But the aliens are always sent by somebody you know. They're always, oh, yeah. Like Todd Bridges.
Aunt Teresa!
Yeah, yeah.
Send those aliens over, girl.
Like Todd Bridges, the reason he got arrested for shooting in the street, he was shooting these green men that were growing in a factory under his house that his grandmother had built.
Okay, so it always ties.
Always ties.
I'm gonna have
to go
back and listen to the episode now and see.
Yeah, well, you may have to prompt them because it's sometimes obscure. But yes, they can beaming thought. But it also makes me wonder: does she have another psychiatric problem too?
Well, she probably had a lot.
Because if
time.
You have other
trauma, big
yeah,
time
if you have
trauma.
Other mental illnesses, sometimes they can be activated by the meth.
But fully aware that it causes this, and yeah. she said they lived with her for I want to say a couple years. But she said they would predict a lot of what has happened now. She said they would tell her
the aliens
mm-hmm, that were sent probably by somebody she knew. She said they would say things like in the future, sex, not physical sex, but you know, gender is not going to be that big of a deal. It's going to be fluid. And she's starting to see, she says, a lot of the things that they told her.
The aliens are coming from her brain and she may have had that insight. That's all. So good for her.
And I mentioned my cousin too. So, my father used to tell us all the time, like he was a built-in say no to drugs campaign for us. A cousin who has paranoid schizophrenia, who was fantastic at all these sports, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, according to him, was acid that set him to the other side. But he never recovered.
Sometimes people get chronic psychosis from that. I don't know that I would call him it's hard to call him a chronic schizophrenic. I've seen horrible psychiatric illnesses from hallucinogens. I've seen bad stuff.
And he said he was doing that stuff. He's like, Ryan, I've probably tried everything that's out there. I'm like, okay. And that scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't smoke weed till I was 21 because of that.
Yeah.
I was always scared I was going to go crazy because I thought that was hereditary too, which it probably is.
It is a little bit.
Yeah, I figured it was. Mm. Who were some of your favorite moments from the show?
Sleepy Rehab?
Yeah.
I had a million of them. There were so many things. Rodman, I had a real attachment to Rodman.
Yeah,
this is a great story. I don't think this went on TV. A lot of stuff didn't go on TV that was just so great.
Let's tell all the stuff that didn't go on TV.
Okay, he was in. It's the first group, and I think he was in the group with like Heidi Fleiss and Tom Sizemore. It was a really rough group, and a lot of stuff was going on. And he was reading a book like this the whole time. Like didn't look up from it. And I go, Dennis, come on, man. These people are working hard. They're pouring their heart out. I want you in the group. It's painful to see you doing that. I want you in the group. And he goes, hey. He goes, all right. He goes, I got to tell you something. You and I, we're going to have a relationship. It's going to take some time, but we will have one. And we did. It took a long time. But we eventually did. I know his mom. I know him. I have great affection for him. But then he was very adversarial. And he goes, you got to understand something if we're going to have a friendship. First thing you got to understand. Here's what you got to understand. He put his hand up here and he goes, there's God. Then he moved his hand down about an inch and he goes, then there's professional athletes. And you got to understand that. You need to understand that if you're going to have a friendship with me. And so I was like, I literally was like, oh, all right, Dennis, that's fine. I get it.
Now, yeah. I mean, he did lead the league in rebounds. Hey, when Michael Jordan led the league in scoring, that's not a lot of opportunities to get rebounds. That's doing some shit,
God,
Dr. Drew.
And then professional athletes.
That's like, fucking great.
It's like, all right, man, that's good. And I accepted that and we became friends. And so. It was really something. That was a good story. Oh God, there were so many.
Who surprised you the most in doing well?
Jenny Ketchum, who was in the sex addiction show. She's also a drug addict, but she didn't know at the time. But we found out, yes, indeed, she was doing lots of drugs, and she's now a social worker in Washington with a kid.
Wow,
she's unbelievable.
What do you mean she didn't know? She just thought I'm doing these drugs, didn't realize it was addiction?
People don't realize how they'll have a primary, like her primary was sex, but they sort of think the other things is not as big a deal. But when they really start to look at it, it's like, oh, I've not gone one day without smoking pot three times a day. I've not gone one day without doing cocaine morning, noon, and night. I've not gone one day without a drink. It's like, That's kind of a problem, isn't it? I'll try to do it. Oh my God, I miss it. That's a problem. And I want to go back. The thing about drug addiction is that you want to go back. It's not just not being able to stop. I mean, that we can kind of interfere with various ways, but you go back. And that's the addiction part. Addiction screws with the part of it screws with the liking and the wanting part of the brain, right? You like it, you like it a little too much. But even when you don't like it, you want it. And the wanting becomes operating on a subconscious level where all the other priorities in your brain start focusing on pursuing the drug, even when you don't realize it. So everything you want to do, everything you're feeling will be directing you back towards using. It's insidious. It shows you how all the rest of the brain works because it all works on behalf of this screwed up motivation.
I'm doing a mental inventory of my life right now here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And?
I mean, someone just told me the other day that I had Afrin to clear my nose. I just wasn't breathing. But I use it like once. I was clogged up. And I spray it, and she goes, "Oh my God, are you addicted to Afrin?" I was like, "What do you mean?"
It's really easy to get addicted.
And that's what she said. She goes, "My two neighbors growing up were addicted, and they would just." I go, "They're getting high off of it." She goes, "No, they're just spraying it because they think they need it."
It's called rhinitis medicamentosa. It actually inflames it, and so you get a few seconds of relief, so you keep going back, but it perpetuates
that dragon.
Perpetuates it, yeah. Rhinitis medicamentosa.
What's the
fancy name? So I'm sure I can come up with more.
Come on.
Okay, let me think about it.
You can.
There are many, many surprises. Well, one of the biggest surprises in sobriety rehab was the process that everybody went through. You got to understand, pretty much everybody that came on that show came to make money, be on TV, and screw with us. They did not intend to get treatment. I mean, they knew they needed treatment, so some part of them was like, all right, some of them wanted treatment. I'll take it back. Some do, but most of them, like Jenny said, she just wanted to screw us up. She just wanted to get and just muck up the program. But every single one of them, save maybe one patient, every single one of them, when they got there and they realized how serious we were about the treatment, they eventually got into it and got involved with it. And this was the transformation that they all went through. And I'm so grateful for it. And I didn't know it was going to happen. By week three, all of them valued their treatment and wanted to share it with the world and wanted to do well by it.
Is that fast? Crazy. Week three seems kind of quick.
It
huh?
does. I could not have predicted it. It was crazy. Now, again, it's in front of cameras, so they know they're being held accountable. They're being paid. That's why they want to do it. They aren't being, people misbehave. I normally kick people out of treatment. These guys were staying the treatment. And so it was really an interesting.
Did they sleep over? Are they allowed to go home?
Oh, no. This was we were in a hospital. This was intense treatment. It was very intense. And we did hours of group every day and hours of individual therapy and stuff and lots of 12 step. And, and it was rewarding. It was really good. And a lot of people did well. A lot of people are sober today because of that show. A lot.
You still keep in touch or up? Or they keep in touch with you?
Oh, yeah. Some, they're just amazing. Amber Smith is amazing. Jenny's amazing. Sizemore, better and sometimes great. Heidi seems great. I mean, just they all seem very much benefited.
And each person, I imagine, is a different case. Even if these three people are addicted to cocaine,
treatment
is different for everything, is it not? They all have aluminum on their windows.
There's different stuff for different people at different times, and it's all got to be individualized for sure.
The toughest for you?
Well, the toughest, and the reason I'm not doing it as actively now as I used to, is the opiate epidemic drove me insane. The patients would come in strung out on opiates, pain. Jeff Conway was a perfect example of that. Do you remember Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
Pain, I'm in pain. Jeff, what's
from Taxi, right?
Yeah. What's your pain on a scale of 10? 20, 15. You can't even imagine it. Take them off the opiates within 2 weeks, no pain medicine, all when you won't talk about the pain unless prompted. And when prompted, we'll always say like 5, 6. Jeff Conway tap danced in front of me. He tap danced. He believed an angel had visited him, took his pain away. Of course, he leaves the hospital, goes back, talks to his doctors. They go, why are you listening to those people? I'm your doctor. You need to take these medicines. You tell that to a drug addict?
Especially coming from a doctor.
Jeff Conway dead. Mike Starr. Wow. Severe opiate addict. We couldn't believe we got him clean. He was like a legendary poly drug addict. Methadone, we got him off. Methadone, we got him off. Everything. We were working with him. We worked with most people. If they wanted it, we worked them for up to a year after treatment. And Mike, we worked really hard with. Bob was seeing him all the time. And he was in sober living, and he stayed sober. Finally, after about a year or 8 months, one day he goes, "I'm moving to Utah." We're like, "Oh, dude, no, please, Mike, don't. And he goes, "No, I'm moving. I'll be right by Cirque Lodge. It's sort of a sober living. I got to get into music again. I'm with these. All the guys are sober. I'll check in with you all the time." Goes, checks in 2 weeks later. He goes, my back hurts. I go, Mike, please, whatever you do, do not tell a doctor your back hurts. Dear God, please don't do that. You understand me? Don't do that. Okay, okay. 2 weeks later, dead. Benzodiazepine opiate for back pain.
At oh. Bedside.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I couldn't take that anymore. I couldn't take it.
I mean, I grew up in Maryland, and by the time I got out of Maryland, it started happening more to the siblings of the kids I grew up with, 3-4 years younger, you know. But I would go back, and there would be billboards all over Maryland that would say, talk to your kids about heroin, talk to your kids about opiates. And I started reading these articles about, at the time, it was coming out of Texas, and it was one of the worst epidemics in the country in that particular state. And they were admitting, you know, daily, I don't know how many of these kids overdosing.
They all started with prescription meds.
That's right.
All started with prescription.
And then that
my
runs
profession
out.
Did all of it. All of it. And it was, I have a lecture series now where I talk about the history of how this happened, because I lived it. And it was unbelievable. It was perpetrated by well-meaning people who became evangelists for pain. And it was just a nightmare. And I was living in it. I remember I was on Larry King the night that Heath Ledger died, and I was on there saying, you don't understand. This is addiction. A doctor did this to him, and it's a tsunami that's going to come over our country. The wave is coming. I see it. I've been living in it. It's about to come crashing down, and then it came.
It did.
It came. I'm telling you, we're looking at a similar problem with homelessness right now, with infectious diseases.
Really?
It's crashing any day. Any day. Anyway, in Los Angeles.
It's set. I just read it's up 16%.
50,000 people, but tuberculosis, typhus, typhoid fever. I missed that one. I predicted
that's that. Back?
Plague is coming back.
Come on.
I guarantee it.
From these
tuberculosis,
like these camps.
Is exploding, and exploding. This is not a static thing. These are sick people decaying in the streets, and nobody's doing anything except letting their sanitation fall apart, and the rodents are just taking over the city. It's bad. It's really going to be bad. So, have a good summer.
So, oh my God! Man. Thinking about relocating right now.
So, oh my God.
How do you feel about marijuana? I see a lot of these NFL players that are on the opiates. And
I'd rather somebody be on marijuana than opiates.
But how do you feel? Because I know you didn't used to be, at least from what I understand, you weren't big pro-marijuana.
I've always been relatively agnostic. Here's what happens. I think Joe Rogan hates me because I treated marijuana addicts. I've treated a lot of them. And when people want to stop who can't, that's when I want to help them. I don't give if people want to use drugs, they should enjoy. I hope they enjoy them. I'm interested in helping people who have a problem stopping when they can't. If you have a problem with a drug and you can't stop and you would like to, that's where I'd like to help them. Everything else, it's on you. Enjoy yourself. That's fine. Experiment. Whatever.
Do you think it could help these guys in the NFL
I'd much rather they smoke pot than take opiates. Much. The full story with cannabis, we're just trying to figure out. I mean, the ridiculous thing is we've not been able to do the research because the government said it was an evil molecule. That's ridiculous. So now we're starting to kind of figure out where it's okay and where it's risky and where it's problematic and getting a much more realistic understanding of the drug. I'm a CBD advocate. I have no problem with cannabis being used by whomever, whenever. And be careful.
I smoke, but these fucking vapes. I had a bad experience on a vape too.
Too intense.
And I won't. It's not intense. It's just, look, you're the doctor, but it's my theory that every single person's body is different.
Yep.
And whatever chemical you put in, it's going to act differently in 100 different people.
Mm-hmm.
And plant is fine for me. But this shit, you know, no one knows what they're putting in these things. You can sit there and tell me it's organic. And, there was a lady, I did a show up north, and there was a bunch of people who work for marijuana. And she's like, have a hit of this pen. I was like, no thanks. I had a bad experience. I'm telling you, one time, and I don't want to go back.
What do you mean bad experience? What happened?
So I was at the Pasadena Rose Bowl.
Huh?
I go out there every few years. I get rid of shit. I just clear clutter out of my life because clearing it out opens up things for, you know, opens up space for new things. And I had this personal bet with my daughter's mother at the time. She's like, why don't you just go out front? And I was like, no, I've done this a bunch. I'm going to make at least, you know, $400, and I'm out there for the day. I'm having fun, whatever.
Yeah.
So I go out by myself, And I know I'm not going to smoke plant because I'm on top of people. So I take this vape pen so I can be discreet, whatever. And at this point, it's still dark. The sun's not up. I'm setting up my little camp and I just take five and I sit on the bumper of the truck and I hit this little pen. And again, here comes the circle closing.
Oh, you had a panic attack. That's what it does for me. It gives me panic.
I feel the strength, the normal strength in my upper body is completely weak.
Yeah.
My chest is heavy.
Panic attack.
And it felt that way for 2 weeks, the strength and everything. I tell my friend who also is an everyday smoker, and he goes, well, let me tell you how that story finishes. I was at a wedding, hit one of those things. He had a seizure. He was rushed to the hospital. He said for a good 10 minutes, he was just so out of it. When they said, you're at the hospital, he's like, Ryan, I didn't even know what the hell, I didn't know what they were saying to
me. He had a seizure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not good.
And they said, you should really do some research yourself about all these places like Colorado where it's been legal for a while. It's sort of this quiet thing. Yeah. This is a handful of years ago, but maybe 5-6 years ago, but it's not really publicized much, but you'll read up. You'll see a lot of these people are having trouble with
seizures, vomiting, depression, paranoias, this stuff happening. We just don't know how much and what time, who, and we don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it helps you, I'm fine.
God, it helps, Dr. Drew. I mean, I talk to my doctor about it all the time. He's offered the pain meds. I'm like, I don't want them.
What does it help?
Anxiety, focus. You know, I don't want to be on anything. I've gone to plenty of therapists, and I even said to the lady one time, you're going to want me to go upstairs. You're going to want me to see a psychologist. They're going to want to put me on pills. And then she started laughing. I said, why are you laughing? She goes, because the guy is upstairs. And I was like, yeah.
Have you ever had trauma therapy?
No. I've never had trauma therapy.
Why don't you do that?
Well, you can maybe set me up with somebody for some trauma therapy. I would love to talk to somebody.
Because it's like EMDR and that kind of thing. That's what you need. That's where the anxiety is coming from.
Oh, that'll help
But
me
you can't do it on the pod. It doesn't work.
No, I don't go to any sessions high.
Okay. But you'd have to be off for like a week or so.
That's fine. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, I'll clear. And that's the other thing, too. When I feel my lungs, I'll clear it out for a little while and chill on it a little bit.
Good.
But then
it works. Yeah.
I miss it.
You miss it, but you can stop.
That's what I was paying attention to when you said these are people that can't stop. Yeah. And then, but you know,
I always tell people if you don't think you're addicted, stop trying.
Yeah, that's what I did. I was like, let me just go for a month and just clear my lungs out. And then I'll tell you what it did too. The first time I hit it after that month, I was like, ooh, Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really did clear out. Mm-hmm. Look, we're there at that time, Dr. Drew.
All right, sir. I could go all day.
Give me another story. Give me one more story to close us out, Dr. Drew.
I feel like it should be a celebrity rehab story.
That's fine.
I tell this story a bit, and it's a really interesting, it's an illustrative story about how intense communication can be between people on a non-conscious, non-intellectual kind of level. Because people think that therapy is some sort of, tell me what I should do with my problems. It is not that at all.
It is not.
Yeah. And on one of the addiction shows, we had a guy that was severely abused. Oh, my God, terrible abuse. And he would come in for session and would start telling me about it. And right from the first day, after about 5 minutes of sitting with him, I all of a sudden would hear the opening music of Mad Men. Weird, right? When you've been traumatized, there are parts of yourself that are not regulating and communicating with the rest of your brain, but that part of yourself does want to communicate with the rest of the world. It just doesn't do it through conscious means. It sort of does it through some sort of bodily-based communications and behaviors. And when you sit in therapy with people, you'll hear and feel and smell things that are being communicated by that person. I know it because they're not mine. I don't hear that music, but in that session, I would hear the music. So we'd come in every day, pum, pum, na, 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 and I'd hear it every day. And then as time went on and he'd be telling me these horrible stories, not only would I hear the music, I would feel like I was that character floating through the buildings, you know, shadowy thing. I'd feel falling and I'd go, wow, this is really interesting. I wonder what this means. It's clearly not coming from me. It's something we're creating together here, he and I. And after about a week or so, it came in, music, falling. And while he was just telling me this horrible tale, all of a sudden, I had this feeling that I was not just falling through these buildings and the music and everything. I was a baby. I was a baby falling through the buildings. And it just took my breath away. I was like, oh my God, that's so painful. And I stopped him in the middle of some horrible story. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm having an experience, and I'm wondering if this is meaningful to you. And I told him what was happening. He went, fuck you, you and all your psychobabble and your blah, blah, blah. He stormed out of the room. Came back the next day, and he went, how did you know? How did you know? It's in my head all the time. It's the baby. It's the crying baby. The baby.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. And I have, and stuff like that happens all the time in therapy, where things get communicated on a bodily basis that if you're really paying attention.
You're like not an just open channel.
It's not like, it's like listening with your body and not just your ears. Because, you know, when we're going through the world, we don't listen to the things that are the way off in the distance, things and images and sounds that we might be, if we really paid attention and did nothing but focus on another person. And indeed, we're open completely to them. And stuff happens. And by the way, having been the subject, an object of therapy, I went to therapy for 11 years finally. In my 30s, I was still having anxiety. One of our kids needed brain surgery when he was one, and I went into such a panic. Man. And my wife called me one day at the psych hospital, and she goes, you need to see a therapist. I was like, I was spinning like a top. Like, yeah, I know, I need to go. I'd love to. One day, she goes, you need to go. And I was like, it just like caught me. I was like, oh, okay, I hear what you're telling me. I'm going. And I went for 11 years. And it was one of those powerful experiences of my life, important experiences of my life. All the shit with my mom and dad stuff got all repaired. And it made me very, in because I'd been the subject of somebody deeply listening on the same way, I could then use that to help other people. So how about that's a way to finish?
Well, let me ask you one more question now. That's a great way to finish. But as a father now, going through what you did with your parents,
yeah.
Do you find yourself trying to overcorrect? Do you find
always
yourself,
you always do the same or too much? Yeah. You do the same with your parents, or you overcorrect? And but I think the therapy washed a bit of that out. And mostly, I'm overcorrecting a little bit now, not being as pushy as my parents were. I'm sort of letting my kids find their way. But I think they would experience me as pushy though.
Yeah, well, every kid was going to think their parents are pushy, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're the fucking man, Dr. Drew. Thank you so much for coming on here. Will you please, one more time, promote whatever you'd like, say again,
just
get
it all at drdrew.com. Watch the Dr. Drew After Dark. That's my favorite podcast right now. Let's do that.
Mine too, brother. I am Ryan Sickler on all social media, ryansickler.com. We'll talk to you all next week.